A lesson we probably should listen to before it's too late. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be here, and this is a very interesting topic. I'm always intrigued by the ability to sit here and look at examples and think them through and see if they'll how well they fit.
Well, that's true, and we've been talking a little bit, if you've joined us over the last couple of days. We've been talking about an article. It was found on the American Thinker website, AmericanThinker.com, by a gentleman by the name of Darren Genescu, called Conservative Third-Party Dreams and Realities. We have put this in juxtaposition to what's happening in America today, especially dealing with the, shall we say, strained relationship between the one of the two major parties, the Republicans, and the Tea Party groups. Many have been advocating forming the Tea Party Party. And Mr. Genescu is actually giving us a little history lesson and some food for thought coming out of our neighbor to the north, Canada, and how their system dealt with and the consequence and consequent results of splitting and merging and creating alliances around certain groupings, where we started with what they called the PCs, or the Conservative Party, and the Liberal Party. In Canada back in the 80s sounds much like the U.S. today. We're moving toward incipient socialism. Most of our elected officials seem to want to continue to move headlong in that direction, and they're really not listening to the votes, and they're splitting it up among the power centers in the larger cities and in the eastern seaboard establishments. And what happened was the folks in the West got sick of the whole thing and split off from the Conservative Party to form the Reform Party and started winning some regional seats, but only in the West. And all they did was split the vote in the East and allow the Liberal Party to come back into power strong and basically control Canada for that length of time. What we're going to talk about today, Chuck, we're moving into the 2000s, and because what happened was, as they saw that they were not gaining enough traction as the Reform Party by themselves, around 2000, the leaders decided, as Genescu writes, they were going to unite the right by forming an alliance with the Conservative Party, the party that they had broken away from. So they realized that if they just kept fighting each other, all was going to happen was their common enemy actually won. And so they decided to go back and try to create an alliance with the Conservatives. However, the Conservative Party was having none of it at that point. Although when it happened, they broke off and formed what's called the Canadian Alliance. It took them 3 years, but finally the Reform Party and the folks in the alliance and the Conservatives finally joined forces and renamed their party the Conservative Party. That sounds fairly familiar, doesn't it?
Sure does. Well, sure does.
Yes, it does. And a gentleman by the name of Stephen Harper became the head of the Conservative Party, the new post-2003 Conservative Party. And basically it says that Harper, and this is Genescu writing, though a substantial move to the right of the old Conservative parties like Brian Mulroney, personified the compromised conservatism required to convince the PC party to accept the merger. So in other words, the folks who had split apart on principle, the reformers, came back to the other PCs to say, hey, listen, you know what? You guys don't have any strength whatsoever in your old establishment areas and in the large cities. We're winning some seats in the West, but it's not enough to create a bloc big enough to take control, and the liberals are winning. And how about we rejoin forces? Well, the only way they could do it is to come off their principles, is to compromise on those things that caused them to split from the PC in the first place. Now, it says that less principled than Manning, who they talked about earlier, who was another one of the reform leaders, but for that reason, more adaptable to the established machinery of federal politics, Harper's led the Conservative Party to three consecutive election victories, finally securing a majority government in 2011, last year. So basically what Genescu is really saying is that those who split apart because of principle found after time that they had to come back and compromise some of those principles in order to create a winning coalition with the former moderate to liberal factions in the old Conservative Party in order to basically unite enough of a vote in order to make it work.
Well, we need to talk a little bit about, again, I'm only slightly familiar with Canadian politics, but I know this. There's an old saying that the further away you are from Toronto, the less excited you are about being part of the Canadian Union, if you will. there are strong factions in Western Canada who would very much like to break away and possibly do something like join up with the United States or form their own union. There are also some of the eastern provinces who don't particularly like Ontario and Quebec. I think Newfoundland, Labrador, some of those guys aren't really all that hyped on being part of the Canadian Union. They stick with it because I think the Labradorans and the Newfoundlanders and the Nova Scotians, those are relatively poor provinces, and I think that they're sucking on the welfare teat, if you will. But the Western Canadians are basically tired of having their pockets picked to run the welfare state. And this is part of the dynamic. They have strong regional parties, and I don't think we necessarily have that yet in this country.
No, I don't believe we have that at all in this country at this point. Regardless of the Tea Party groups, whether it's be the 912 or the Patriot groups or the Liberty factions, that's just what they are, Chuck. Right now they're factions. They're small groupings, usually, and if one gets to a point of where it looks like it's going to have some influence, that's usually when you get people from the establishment Republican Party coming in and insinuating themselves into positions of leadership in the movement, in order to make sure it's steered the right direction.
Exactly. And that's the problem. The Tea Party guys are finding themselves infiltrated, and they don't have the political savvy to recognize, well, there's only one way to put it, RINO. And anybody out there should know what RINO means, R-I-N-O, Republican in name only.
All right.
And by that, I mean a liberal to moderate Republican, because the name RINO assumes conservatism, which is not necessarily the case inside the Republican Party. As we've seen with the number of, even here in Ohio, let's face it, we've had Mike DeWine, who we thought we put in the coffin and nailed the lid shut on, and the next thing we know, we had him forced down our throat as a candidate for attorney general with much political maneuvering. That being said, this is the kind of thing that happened. The Tea Party never would have stood for Mike DeWine as a candidate for anything above, I think, drain commissioner, probably.
Well, possibly not.
But the party apparatus said, this is your only choice, and we would have had to stick with his predecessor, who was, shall we say, not the greatest attorney general in history, of having taken over from one of the most corrupt attorney generals in the state's history.
That's right. And you're talking about the previous attorney general was Rich Cordray.
And he took over
for Mark Dan. That's right.
And Cordray probably did the best job he could stepping into the situation that he did. Because let's face it, Mark Dan was influence peddling from day one. And if the Tea Party wants to do this, they're going to have to listen to some of the advice that's given in this article. Because I think some of these number-pointed things are very important.
You're absolutely right. And if I may, I want to just... We talked about this a little bit. What have this new alliance, this conservative party, actually done? Well, they've lowered some taxes. And this is according to Genesco in his article. They've maintained a more business-friendly environment, whatever that means, corporatism probably, resisted some of the more extreme green economy gobbledygook in favor of promoting Canada as a major oil producer, guided the country through the 2008 recession, and adopted a somewhat more robust, i.e. less UN-centered, foreign policy. Well, these are all good things, Chuck.
Those are great things, yeah.
But the big problem is the trade-off that's involved. And this is something that I believe many of the folks in our own American Tea Party movements are going to have to be very wary of, because many of them are Christian believers. He says, in order to achieve this, however, the party, the Conservative Party, had to jettison most of the social conservative issues, allow Canada's socialized healthcare system to stand fundamentally unquestioned, step lightly around the nation's leftist federal agencies, and in general do far less than conservative voters would have hoped to dismantle the country's statist engine. So basically he's saying this is the trade-off that they had to have, which is basically you're not moving anywhere on social issues and you're barely moving forward on fiscal issues, but you're in power. So if power is the only name of the game, then they've been wildly successful by taking over in 2007 and mounting in wins through 2007 up to the point of securing the majority last year. But Genescu wants us to take some object lessons from this. And he says, basically, okay, anybody can bash apart the differences between Canadian and American forms of government and those examples, but he said, here's some considerations to be drawn from the Canadian conservative Petri dish. In other words, what he's just explained to you in the history. He said, basically, number one, in order for a third party to do more than disastrously split the nominally conservative vote, it must earn a voice in national elective office. In other words, A, merely running a presidential candidate is ineffectual unless the goal were precisely to help Obama win re-election, and B, merely having a name on the ballot in 100 congressional districts like the Libertarians provides little more than a soundproof room for the disaffected to vent their anger. In other words, you have got to think more strategically. He says that basically you're going to have to narrow down and try to win a seat or two in Congress from various areas where you have pockets of strength in order to start building.
Well, Barry, if you'll recall from our third party experience.
Oh, yes.
Let's talk about this for a minute. We would go to national committee meetings and we would be told about these Western parties who were being highly successful, quote unquote. Let's get something straight. One of these states claimed 33,000 party members. They got about 4,000 of them to vote for the presidential candidate, I think.
That's about right.
Now, we had 76 members. We got 12,000 presidential votes. So, and they were telling us how to run our party. Okay, that being the case, how did they do things? They would have people that actually came in to volunteer as a third-party volunteer, would sign up, true members of the party, not people who signed up for the party because it had the name independent in it, and they thought they were signing up as an independent voter. What they were doing was someone would come in and volunteer, okay, what office are you running for? They were just simply filling candidate slots everywhere. State representative, state senator, mayor, city council, governor, U.S. senator.
If I remember correctly, they actually went one candidate for Congress who was a former wrestler who went around with a big stuffed blue ox.
Yeah, that's right.
As part of his routine.
I forgot about that. Yeah, this was the big selling point, and I think he also wore 2 6 guns.
Something of that nature, yeah.
He had a cowboy outfit and a stuffed buffalo. I forgot about that. But this is the caliber of people. It was how we were supposed to run our party. Would that kind of thing bring publicity? Yes. What would it do about people thinking of that you were a serious contender for office? Let's face it, I don't think so. Would you vote for a guy with a giant stuffed buffalo in a cowboy outfit? Maybe to go to the loony bin, but not to be my representative in Congress. And this is one of the things that he's talking about here. You can't just simply start running everybody who comes in through the door for some kind of office.
Well, that's true.
You have to pick serious candidates who have some kind of functional knowledge of the issues that he's going to have to deal with. That can be a problem. Now, it looks like the Canadians have overcome that, especially by their strong regional parties in the West. They have candidates who have developed a knowledge of the things they're going to be dealing with at the national level, something that right now America's third parties, with very few exceptions, aren't doing.
That's right. But Genesco goes on because, you know, he talks about, you know, building these critical masses in a single state in order to win some congressional seats and therefore getting clout at the federal level. And he says, well, even with electoral strength regionally, nationwide success for a third party is a multi-election project. The question conservatives would have to ask themselves is how many election cycles can America survive while waiting for the new constitutionalist party to gain enough steam to wrest number one conservative party status away from the GOP? But he said, well, could we do it? Could they actually, you know, do it, shorten up the time frame and do this and get some Republican sitting congressmen to jump to the new party? And he said, well, basically maybe the one person or two, Ron Paul and maybe one other elected Republican might join your new party. And I'm assuming he's talking about Rand Paul, Ron's son.
Yeah.
But the fact that the vast majority of the GOP would basically make the attack this party, make the attacks on Santorum, Bachman, and Palin look like warm hugs.
Okay, we're just about out of time here.
Mm-hmm.
Hold that thought, because I'm sitting here saying to myself, Ron Paul and Rand Paul are not going to jump ship.
No, they're not.
That's not going to happen because Ron Paul has tried that strategy.
Yes, he has. He ran as a Libertarian Party presidential candidate in 1988.
That's right, and he's not dumb. That's why he's never done it again.
Exactly. Well, probably we should come back for tomorrow's program and talk about the rest of the analogies that we can draw from the history of the third party movement in Canada to see what may be the future of our own Tea Party or third party coalitions in the United States.
Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.